when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the HIV Podcast. Each week, we focus on a person, historical event, or pop culture moment linked to HIV and explore the story of what actually happened. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Jess. And between us, we've been working in the field of HIV for 40 years. Our aim is to get as many people as possible HIV educated.
Welcome to the HIV Podcast.
This week's special guest is a prominent figure in our sector. He's an activist, never afraid to speak his mind, open about his HIV status, and is just starting out in a completely new direction after a career in the armed forces. Welcome, Ollie Brown.
Hello.
Oh, I'm sorry, it's just me clapping.
I was going to say, Jess is there clapping in spirit.
Yes, I might get Zoe to add sound effects. Lots of applause.
Just get Wembley Stadium.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. So first of all, how are you?
Good. Just sort of getting used to life, without a uniform. So it's almost like a grieving process because it's a vocation more than a job and it's all consuming. So it's a shock to the system, that just taking time and taking it in my step. So, but yeah, as ever, just looking forward, and looking for the next person I get to, annoy with a problem that I found. So
oh, fantastic. So I mean, this is a big change for you, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later on. But I also wanted to talk about how you were diagnosed, because I've done my research, Ollie. This will surprise you, because you do listen regularly to the podcast, so you know how haphazard it is normally. And I know you were diagnosed in A&E, weren't you?
Yeah.
What happened?
I simply sum it up as a biker bottle and a brick wall, because I was working in London and I was cycling through London. I was on my bike, plastic bottle got caught in the tyre, ended up losing control, sliding along a brick wall and then sliding along the floor. Got up, sort of looked myself over and thought, oh, finger needs a bit of help. And had no idea where to go, phoned a friend who I knew was London based, and it worked out that Chelsea and Westminster was the only place closest to go to. So got in a taxi, turned up, went into A&E, but one thing led to another. From going, oh, I've got a sliced up finger, can you have a look at it? They found my blood oxygen was low, so they had concerns that I had internal bleeding. So they did a full chest x-ray, found blurring around my lymph nodes. So they then did a full body CT and blood tests. At that point, they were looking for early indications of cancer. That was their line of thinking. But unbeknown to me at the time, Chelsea and Westminster was still conducting an opt-out HIV test trial. And as a result of my bloods being taken in that A&E setting, I was tested for HIV as part of that. So I was then contacted and had the news broken that they'd found the answer. And they said that told me that I had been diagnosed with HIV. my immediate response, as odd as it sounds, was, well, at least it's not cancer.
Yeah, yeah.
The odd, even odder part of that is I didn't really know about HIV, but I still gave it that pecking order.
Mm.
My reference point was Rent the Musical. Be back then and cancer.
It's
actually not too dissimilar in a way. Whereas now, HIV, it's lower than diabetes in its effect on life.
Mm.
So I didn't even know, but that was my reaction. So it was quite a out of the blue diagnosis. I'd only had one HIV test prior to then.
Mm.
Because whenever I went for a sexual health screening, I was considered not a risk. I present in a heteronormative manner, so mm-hmm. I wasn't seen as a at-risk person. And for me, sexuality is, well, I told 5 million people I had HIV before I'd even had a conversation with my family about my sexuality. So I very much just don't see it as a thing. And basically came out to my family by saying, hi, meet Rob. So in the family WhatsApp group, it was quite a just a laissez-faire. Here you go. Nothing to it.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. Well, it should be.
So that's always been my attitude. So because I'm Ollie, I'm not straight, gay, bi, or whatever label people feel there is, the system missed me. So I was never targeted, never seen as at risk. And as there's been the studies, people in sexual health services are fearful to offer a test to someone they feel isn't of the stigmatized communities.
Oh, wow. Yeah. There's a lesson to be learnt there, isn't there? I do think we're quite rigid, aren't we? And it's these groups that are at high risk, and those are the people that we should be targeting. We generally don't think outside of those parameters.
Yeah, we talk about hard to reach communities. Mm. Of Black African males, etc. No, my view is your hard to reach community is your white heterosexual male.
Yeah.
It's not ones that it's hard to communicate with or hard to get into the community with.
Mm.
It's those that don't test.
Yeah.
So your hard to reach is the hardest to achieve.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So already, I mean, I can tell you're very practical. Is this like a military thing or is this you?
I've always said that, yes, I joined the military when I was 18, 19, but there's always something that drew me to the military because I'm the youngest of four. So to have four kids, you have to run a household like the military. So it's sort of just in the mindset. And my dad is very practical. He's an engineer. So I think it's very much nurture and nature together, compounded by the military on top of that.
Yeah. And you told your employers quite early on, didn't you?
Yes. So within 24 hours, I'd told over 20 people. I've always been take me as I am or don't, because I don't have the time if you don't like it. So when I was diagnosed, I walked out Chelsea and Westminster Hospital, then into the Cobler Clinic, and everything was stacked up one from another, all of the support there. Then I walked out the door. I'm working and living in London. I don't live there full time. So I just scrolled through my phone thinking, right, who is there? Ended up speaking with someone I went through training with and had worked with relatively recently called Debbie. Went over to Whitehall, to where the Ministry of Defence, met her on the steps of the entrance. She could see there was I wasn't okay. So we went to a quieter location, which happened to be the Montgomery Memorial directly opposite 10 Downing Street, just around lunchtime during the week. So when you say quiet,
not that quiet.
Wouldn't notice you because everyone's just going past. And literally just told her there and then, I've been diagnosed with HIV. Best response ever. I think we need a drink. So we went up to Trafalgar Square and Debbie ordered a bottle of Prosecco and then we just sat there and talked. Then I phoned my parents, phoned home to find that my dad was out. So then set up a conference call with my mum and dad, told them, told my sister and sort of my immediate family. told my line manager at work, because that's ultimately my support network at this time. Told the whole office. So I was working for the head of the Navy, the First Sea Lord. It's a fast-paced job. It's long hours. It's non-stop. So actually, how are you going to cope if people can't look out for you? So that was then five people in the office. So within 24 hours, my whole family, my immediate office, and a few close friends, I'd already told that I was diagnosed with HIV. So an enigma in that sense, not that it's a competition.
And again, if that's your personality, right? This is just what you see is what you get. I've had this news. I'm going to need your help to deal with it. By the way, Debbie sounds awesome. I think we all need a Debbie in our lives.
Yes. Well, I've got two Debbies, because effectively you've got Debbie in the Navy and then Debbie from the Terence Higgins Trust. Oddly, two Debbies throughout that have been a great support. So,
I mean, it's a different way of dealing with a diagnosis. I mean, I'd say you are quite rare. I think most people, it takes a long time for it to sink in. And it's fascinating to hear kind of the flip side of that, to meet somebody that's like, no, this is what's happening and this is how I'm going to control it and deal with it.
But at the same time, it did take a long time to sink in an odd way.
Did it? Okay.
Yeah. Because I carried on like that for a year, but because I've told everyone, I've dealt with it. But also, now I look back and I told people I had HIV. I then bombarded them with statistics, information, facts. And people generally don't go, oh, how are you? And even if we say, oh, are you okay? We don't want the answer no.
Yeah.
So actually, I just avoided the emotional engagement around HIV. It stayed factual. I'd flipped into the military mentality of, okay, what do I need to do? Tick the boxes, go through the process. I've completed the process, park it, compartmentalize it, move it over there. A year later, when I changed jobs, I went on a short course. And when I first met my instructor, told them everything, etc. And then they asked me, so how are you dealing with it? And I did my usual and they went, no, how are you actually dealing with it? And that was the start. That tugged on the threads that then led to me realizing, no, I'm not actually dealing with it. I've described it as a tangled ball of red string, but so tangled, I couldn't find the ends. So it's just this dense ball, and I'm just looking at it, almost just jabbing and trying to grab at it. But there's never an end of the string to start trying to unravel it.
Yeah. Okay. And so what happened then? Does everything come crashing down or?
Yes. And it was at one specific point when I had moved to join a ship, and it was a couple of days before it sailed. And it was that idea of, okay, I'm going to be out at sea with around 200 other people. No one knows. If someone finds out in everyday life, you can go home to your safe place. You can remove yourself from the situation. If someone finds out in that 200 community, everyone's going to find out. And where can you go? Because you can't just step off the ship.
Yes.
That's mental, almost that fear of, I don't know how to control this situation. That I basically just realized, no, I'm not okay. I'll say, professional masker. I've always throughout my career been able to put on the face, walk out as if nothing's wrong. And this was so extreme that I was walking back into my cabin on the ship, sitting down, staring at the wall, bursting into complete hysterics, then going, right, I need to go do that. Standing up and walking out without even a heartbeat. And then walking out, going to do what I did. Then walked back in, sat down, carried on like that. The distance between the mask and reality was just so taut. It was a brick.
Yeah.
And that's where I went, no, I'm not okay. And we've got this wonderful system in the military of the chaplaincy.
Yes.
Doesn't matter if you're religious or not. They may be. And I exemplify the level of non-religiousness of their support of one of the first people I told that I was gay was a Catholic priest.
Really?
So that just gives you an idea of the level of non-religiousness of the interactions, with no judgment, it was just a supportive conversation. So I reached out to the chaplaincy, phoned them and just went, I'm not okay. And that's where everything kicks in. I left the ship, was medically downgraded, but then came home, was living by myself and realised that support was going to be about 8-9 months before it could kick in. So I was thinking, I'm not going to sit here staring at the wall for 8-9 months. And that's where I then worked with the Navy to get support from the Terence Higgins Trust through their counselling service, because I was like, as you said, practical attitude to things. I was like, right, there must be a way to get on with this.
Mm.
And that was ultimately the route that started everything off.
Oh, so that's kind of setting you back on the right path, because yes. I was beginning to think that you were a bit mechanical. Like, they really do train the armed forces, don't they, to just not deal with emotion.
It's a useful skill.
Yeah.
Used in the right way, in the right quantity. It's when I used it sustained and kept going, it's unhealthy.
Yeah. Yeah. And you've got that kind of self-awareness and that strength to identify that and then do something about it. Honestly, Ollie, if I was in some sort of emergency situation, I am straight on the phone to you.
You'll find that nothing will faze me. You could literally be there just going, oh yeah, I'm missing a leg. I'm not sure where my arm is. And I'll just be like, right, it's no worries. Just sit down. So you can be screaming and I'll be like, that's fine. Don't worry.
Yeah, it's all good.
We'll find your arm. It'll be here somewhere.
Yes. Oh, so you just mentioned that you kind of worked with Terence Higgins Trust to, what, educate the Navy?
Well, eventually, in a way. So individuals in the Navy, like my line manager at the time, absolutely amazing, had a really good understanding. And that makes sense when you realise that she was the vice president of the Royal Navy Rugby Union, so was aware of Gareth Thomas.
Right.
So that meant that she had more knowledge than me when I was diagnosed. So really lucked out that she was my immediate line manager at the time. But the Terence Higgins Trust first helped me understand it with the counseling service, I think was the biggest part. And during that time, I carried on as usual. And I knew that I would face challenges in the Navy because ultimately I was medically limited deployable due to my HIV status. But at the same time, I had the privilege of having access to the head of the Navy. I travelled with him, worked with him, basically became part of his family as such for that period. So I had the conversation with him walking along South Kensington High Street at the traffic lights when a cyclist went past. And then he said, oh, did you ever get the results from that test? And I just went, yeah, I was diagnosed with HIV. And so he just went strolling across the street. So I knew that I had the ultimate support, as it were, because his reaction was, well, that shouldn't be a problem.
Hmm.
He was aware of what it meant today and went, no, it shouldn't affect you in service. So I had his support. It wasn't until I had done the counselling, I was in the stigma and resilience workshops with the Terence Higgins Trust, that I realised that my mentality and attitude was resounding with a lot of people in the group. Just my, well, yeah, so what attitude and all these different pieces. And also just going, well, do you actually understand? Why do you disclose when you're having sex? And just going, well, would you tell them that you've got diabetes? Would you tell them you've got gallstones? Would you tell them any of these conditions that you can't give them? No. Well, you've got a condition that you can't give them.
Yes.
So putting that logic out there. So that just sort of took the whole process forward and sort of put my mind back into the day I was diagnosed, into what I say was the broom cupboard in the clinic, because they're never large, these consults.
No, they're not.
Both of you shuffle in past the desk. And the three things I didn't know is, do I still have a life? When will I die? What's my life going to be like? And do I still have a job? And those three questions I presented to the doctor. Her name was Jo. And when I said, do I still have a job? She hit the roof.
Oh, really?
Absolutely went ballistic. And I didn't think anything of it at the time. I was sort of like, well, I'm in the military. But then going through the journey, I then went, well, actually, hang on a minute. If that's the reaction, why?
Hmm.
So that then started me digging into things. And then me being me, I was sat in a session with the Chronic Conditions and Disabilities Network in Defence. There's about 40 people on the call and they're discussing why people don't know about the network. And I just said, well, it's because of the way that you approach promoting the network. And they're like, what do you mean? And it's like, well, you put the condition before the network and you rarely reference the network. They couldn't understand what I was saying. I was like, okay, so if I introduce myself and I go, oh, I have HIV and I'm supported by the Candid Network. And then it was silent and they went, sorry, what? And I was like, yeah, so you just explain it, that you have to state what you have and supported by the candidate network. Everyone else, everyone here goes, I have HIV or I have Crohn's or I have cancer. Mm. And they went, no, sorry, you've got HIV. And I was like, yeah. So it was just sort of dropped out there. And then they asked me, would you do a talk for us? I went, okay. And then picked a date in about 2-3 weeks' time. And then went to the Terence Higgins Trust. Been asked to do a talk in defence. When? Just in a few weeks. And then did a talk to just over 100 people across defence from all ranks, civilians, military. And it actually ended the conversation with, I have HIV, so what? And that's where the ball was firmly shoved down the hill. And everything, momentum built up, because no one could answer it. No one could answer why. Because I just told them all the information. I told them all the real facts. I pulled out all the policies and they're gone, yeah, but I've got HIV, so what? Why does it matter?
Yeah.
But you're saying it does matter and there's no reason for it.
Oh, this is good stuff, yeah. Isn't it? Did they just accept it? Was it like a light bulb moment for them? Or is this just the start of many conversations to get them into that mindset?
So it was the start of many conversations, but they were in that mindset. Right. It's one thing I still tussle with today. Organisations, okay. Individuals make an organisation, but how many individuals' minds do you need to change to get the organisation to change? And that's what we're sort of facing. How do you get everyone's interest and momentum? And it was having senior support that then ended up with conversations in corridors that basically amplified the conversation within the service and the other services, doing things like just phoning up the head of diversity and inclusion in the army and going, oh, well, I'm sorry, but your policy is quite offensive and borderline illegal. And just literally going, not disrespectfully, but just going around the system. We have ranks. Yeah, but it doesn't mean I can't talk to you. It's people seem to think that it means that you have to follow the chain. No, you go by the most expeditious route and just go, yeah, this is the situation. You're the person to deal with it. So deal with it. And they sent an email out that afternoon saying, this policy has been highlighted to me. These are the concerns. If question, I'm deleting it. So I was like, well, that's sufficient.
Oh.
So, because they said, if no one's raised it as a problem until now and it's not been updated for years, it's clearly not needed.
And they're right.
Yeah. And I thought, oh, actually, I'd prefer to have no reference to HIV in a way, because if there's no rule, you're not restricted.
That's very true, actually. And if we're trying to normalise this, which I think we all are, that's the right approach.
You don't need something written. It just needs to be. So that was everything inside. And it was the sort of me being the inside person whilst THT were able to leverage the outside and give that agitation of, we know what's going on from the public side, but also then being able to leverage their network across other government departments to get Government Equalities Office on board, and even to the point that Number 10 were on board. So you've got the whole of government moving in the same direction, but also, as odd as it sounds, being able to know what each other is thinking without talking, because we were doing the talking for them.
Yeah.
We were making sure everyone was on the same page. So when it came to the big meeting, they all went in apprehensive to then sit down and go, oh, we all agree from the beginning.
Oh, okay.
So we had shaped it so that once it got to the crunch point, it would go, everyone would go, oh, okay. And then the final stage is, we'd all the conversations behind it had happened before. So it just meant that it went smoothly. Then the final hurdle is, okay, we've agreed this. Let's make it happen. That's generally the hardest part. We've said yes. When are we going to do it? Government, particularly at the time, loves nothing better than having a story. Saying we've changed a policy doesn't make a story. Having a face does. And that's where effectively sold my soul to the devil and went, okay, you can have my story. I will go into the media alongside that policy announcement.
Oh my goodness.
But I didn't do it by World AIDS Day. So I went, you can have it, but I want to do it then.
Yeah.
just so that then there was that incentive for them. And if they didn't do it, then you don't have me.
Hmm.
So it just wrapped it up with an incentive, because the only other incentive that I did use when I was asked, well, why should we do this, was because it's the right thing to do. I'm not going to stand here and shout at you about a load of benefits and cost bonuses. It's the right thing to do. Get on with it. So between those two just simple ways, they agreed. And everyone's favourite paper, the Daily Mail, had a line in it which sums up the whole situation, which was, this announcement progressed so fast that even our sources didn't know it was happening.
Really?
So we outmaneuvered the Daily Mail's sources. They asked their sources and they went, we didn't even know what's going on.
I would expect nothing less from the military.
Excellent. Yeah, but that's when I took the conscious decision to speak out, knowing it would have an impact. And ultimately, as you said, formally of the Navy, I knew that would be the ultimate outcome, for various reasons. And as I said, Debbie Laycock from Terence Higgins Trust, it's probably one of the first conversations that we had, whereas I know what the ending will be. What I don't know is when.
Yeah, yeah. Gosh, so you've gone like not even national, probably international now with your diagnosis. But the result is that you've changed policies, that it's not just the Navy's working to, is it? It's the other armed forces as well, the Army, the Air Force.
Yeah, so you can now join the UK Armed Forces if you're living with HIV.
Oh, Ollie, how does that feel? You've engineered that.
So it didn't feel real until I got a phone call from Richard Angel, the now chief executive. I was shopping in Lidl, just wandering down the middle aisle. and he phoned me because he was at a conference, and their case study had been presented of an individual who was a child living with HIV. They were lost to care, completely disengaged. And it turned out that they were living on the streets, but happened to hear or see about my story. And they went from there to re-engaging with care, and looking to pursue a career in the Navy, just because they realized that gave them that hope.
Yeah.
And I've always said, I've not done this to change the military, to change policies. I've done it to make sure that just one other person doesn't have to feel how I did or go through what I did. And it doesn't matter. So long as there's just one other person that doesn't have to do it, that's all I did it for.
Yeah. Yeah. To make a difference to other people.
Yeah. And the amount of them, it doesn't matter. Just one.
Mm.
Just so they didn't have to face it. And coincidentally, there's now an informal guideline rule that Royal Navy Medical takes the approach of. One of them jokingly said, oh yeah, it's almost like the Ollie rule. because if an issue is raised to them, it's quite often they sort of like, oh no, we've got bigger things to deal with. They're now going, no, does it affect one person?
Mm.
And if it affects one person, they deal with it.
Brilliant.
And it's just that mentality of, yeah, if there's something wrong and it affects one person, it must affect another. It must affect more, but they're the unseen.
Mm.
They're the people without a voice. So yeah. Take what the one voice that you do have and do something about it.
And you got an MBE for this, didn't you?
Yes, yeah. So it was King Charles's first honours list. And there was an aspect of poetic justice to it, because I did have a comment slung in my direction of, oh, you're only doing this to get three letters after your name. And I responded, no, I'm good, thanks. I've already got three letters, it's HIV. So it's a great sort of honour, but it's like getting a degree or a GCSE without having sat an exam.
Mm.
Because to me, I just did it.
Yeah.
It's just something I did. And it sounds a bit almost ungrateful. Oh, no, I just did. Well, I did just do it. But it's great that I've had that recognition. But still, I just sort of sit there and go, yeah. But we jokingly call them in the military MBEs, many buggers efforts. OBEs, other buggers. So, but I do feel that actually it's recognition of many people's efforts, because it marks the face that went out there. There's people like Dr. Joe Heskin at Chelsea and Westminster, who provided all of the medical sort of support information, sat alongside me in many presentations and meetings, all the way through to members of parliament on all sides of the house, members of the House of Lords, Terence Higgins Trust, National AIDS Trust, BASHBA, friends, family, random connections, and support the whole way. A Twitter network. If you find someone trolling me at any point, you'll generally find someone correcting the information or steering them in the right direction.
Nice.
So I've never engaged, but people have on my behalf. On the grounds of combat disinformation, don't try to change their mind, because some people's minds just won't think. So long as the right information is next to it.
Yes. Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay, and you've left the Navy now.
Yes.
What's next for you?
A break. I'm effectively, because there's lots of layers and parts to the journey, and it's just been one situation after another. I've not taken pause. I almost say it was a year coming to terms with HIV. It was a year speaking out with it, and then it was a year dealing with what is can only be sort of described as celebrity, and people knowing you without you knowing them. So that's quite a lot in that time frame to sort of have to deal with. So I'm just going to take 3 months or so just to catch up on life, as in like do some stuff around the house and bits and pieces, but also then actually have those conversations to understand what could I do next.
Yeah.
I've always never seen HIV as my box. HIV just happened to be the subject. What could I apply my skills to next?
That would be easier to say what couldn't you apply them to. You've got such a broad range of skills, it's amazing.
It's like, effectively, just give me a problem.
Well, exactly. There are many problems in the world, Ollie. Come on, we can
absolutely
get to this.
And that's what I'm trying to scope out, understand.
Sure. Yeah.
I've got ideas, but I very much don't restrict myself to my ideas, because actually it's everyone else's ideas that has more interest and value quite often. So see what comes of it. But I'll be a nightmare if I sit around idle. So
I don't think there's any danger of that.
No, absolutely not.
See you at the World Health Organization or some NATO summit leading the way. Come on, guys, this shouldn't be an issue.
Well, if you invite me to large events like that, often people are running away from me because I've given them a hard time somewhere else. So, when it came to opt-out testing, I could be convinced that Amanda Pritchard, chief executive of the NHS, was avoiding me at events, because every time it's like, so where are we?
Well, I like it. I've got one more question for you. And that is, tell us about the tattoo on your toe.
Oh, yes. So my brother, so as I mentioned, I'm the youngest of four. The brother one older than me, Andrew, he is a tattooist and has been since day dot. He was the one sibling out of all of us I least expected to sort of know about HIV, but oddly knew the most, because he proactively took an interest because of his profession. He tattooed me it was post my diagnosis. I think it was about 2020. That was my first and only tattoo at the time. And it's a script of Memento Mori on my foot. And literally, oddly enough, no conversation was needed, nor should there really be as such. But then he phoned me the day after World AIDS Day and said, right, you're coming over to my studio in East London and I'm tattooing a red ribbon on your big toe. That seems a bit random, but it all comes from the fact that we were both in London whilst I was doing the work on the lead up, and we went for a night out, And he asked me the question, so what is HIV to you? And I just went, oh, it's no more or less important than my big toe.
Oh,
it's
just, right.
It's part of me. So, and both him and my other two brothers have the letter B for the surname Brown on their big toes. And it's on the same big toe as them. So he tattooed a red ribbon on my big toe the day after. Basically, I told everyone
nice.
I was living with HIV. But the bit I've subsequently reflected is your big toe is the smallest body part that you can lose and not be able to walk.
Is it really?
Yes. Yeah. So if you don't have your big toes, you're unable to balance.
Right.
So actually, it's almost more profound that it's on my big toe.
Yeah.
And I just made the throwaway comment, it's as important as my big toe, because it is, but actually it's significant whilst being insignificant.
Yeah.
And it is part of me. And I've listened to various ways people refer to it of actually I'm the host to it. Oh, it's just in me. To me, it's just part of me. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
I'm Ollie. So there you go.
Exactly. Yes. It shouldn't identify you, should it?
Yeah. So that.
Brilliant. Do you know what? It's been so lovely talking to you. I know whatever you go on to do, you're going to smash it. I don't think it's in your nature not to be able to do that.
No.
But you are a huge inspiration to everyone here at TVPS.
Oh, thank you. It's great to know that you give people hope. I think that's one of the most sort of uplifting parts.
Yeah.
I sort of always remind myself that in the low times, which there have been many, to know that you've been that something for someone that's given that hope, because so long as you have something to hold on to.
Yeah. Oh, you most definitely do that without a shadow of a doubt. You are ticking that box every single day. So, Ollie, while I've got you here, I need to ask you a question that's nothing to do with HIV, but it's a perfect opportunity for me to solve this problem that I have. Absolutely. How do I stop being seasick every time I go near a boat?
Okay. There's various people swear by different things.
Yes.
Scientifically, if you lay on the floor on your side with your head at the pointy end, the forecastle of the ship.
Seriously?
Yes, because it's the nodding motion that makes you feel seasick.
Really?
Yeah, so if you're in that position and as central to the ship as possible, it isolates the nodding motion.
See, I knew you'd be able to solve this. Can you help me with another issue that I don't understand?
Well, the other one's ginger biscuits.
Oh, well, I'm fully on board with that. Love ginger biscuit.
Ginger biscuits settle your stomach without fail.
How many packets?
As many as you can manage.
Before you're sick.
Yeah, just don't get to the point that you're sick because of too many biscuits and you're sorted.
That will be the challenge for me. Okay, we can do this. The other thing I want to understand, I mean, I'll be honest with you, I don't understand how boats work. I mean, they float because they've got air in them, right? Is that right?
No.
Oh!
Because you open the door and it would sink then otherwise.
Right, okay. Yeah. Oh, how do boats work, Ollie?
So displacement, on the basis that they don't push hard enough down for the water to get inside. So if you put a bowl in the sink.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then if you keep pushing it down, eventually the pressure around the bowl reaches the edge and fills it up. So, and that's why ships capsize, because ultimately, as more of the ship goes into the water, there's more water pushing it up because more area goes in. But eventually it reaches what they call the vanishing point, which where the weight of the ship outdoes the amount of contact there is to the water pushing it back.
Okay. Well, then what submarines? Well, how do submarines float then?
They've got tanks that they let water in and control the amount of water, which changes the amount, how much is pushing them up. So they make themselves heavier and heavier and heavier, that they then go under. And that's how they stay in the same position in the water. So they don't go under and then drop.
Yes.
A set amount of water, and the water pressure around them is then steady. But the scary part is the vanishing point of a ship. Ships are designed with fail safes, whereby if they reach the vanishing point, there's bolts and fixings that are designed to snap if they go too far. So if you're in really rough seas and the ship's tipping really far,
yeah,
inside the main bit, because the top bits could fall off.
Well, this is reassuring.
It's better than it going upside down and everyone dying.
So, I mean, future journeys to France will be under the tunnel, I think.
Yes,
can't
yes.
risk this. Is that what happened in Titanic then?
Oh, no, that snapped in half.
That just...
Yeah. Well, they thought that they were unsinkable because they had changed the way that they had done the compartments, but then they didn't realise that you need to seal the compartments. So they did them vertically and slightly...
I see. So me fretting on a Channel ferry that everyone's breathing in the air too much and we're going to sink is a bit... It's unfounded, really, is it? It's unnecessary.
Well, in theory... on that principle, so say you're on a submarine and you're all inside and everyone was breathing, eventually if you didn't run out of oxygen, just ignore that technicality, you would then turn into a Coke can, a very compacted Coke can.
Oh my God.
See, that'll be what happens when a submarine sinks.
Yeah, I mean, for the record, I'm never going to go on a submarine.
It's like you just get turned, it's like a can crusher.
No way. Have you been on a submarine?
No, I have stood inside the steel ring of a submarine being constructed and walked one not in the water. But no, the submarines are not for me. My brother-in-law does that. That's their problem. But they refer to us as targets.
Oh, that's amazing.
So, if you're not, everything other than a submarine is a target. So,
oh my gosh. Oh, Ollie, we should do our own podcast all about engineering and where you educate me on how things work, because I don't understand how planes work either, but we could discuss that another time.
Oh, I was in the air cadets and I was an air cadet instructor, so I can explain how they work.
Seriously?
Yeah. My sister's got an amazing analogy of men running over a hill and under a hill for a plane wing as to how airflow works. But she did train to be a science teacher, so...
You've just got, like, the cleverest family, haven't you? It's amazing.
Oh, and we all do something totally different. Our parents always said, we don't care what you do, so long as you're happy.
Yeah. Oh, I bet Christmas is a fun when you all get together.
Oh,
it's
no.
Like an episode of QI.
No, it's 24 hours and we're killing each other. So, 48 hours, absolutely not. 24 and a little bit more, we might be able to manage.
Oh, brilliant. Right, that really is it now. We're all done.
Oh, that end was abrupt, Sarah.
Where have you popped up from?
I know, where have I been all episode? It's like I've been secretly listening from behind the sofa quietly.
See, I knew I wasn't alone.
Well, you weren't. You were with Ollie, but I was also there. No, I wasn't.
Right, just to put Ollie's mind at rest, you weren't there lurking in the background, were you? But you are here today, recording this on a different day, a little ending to sum up the episode.
Yes, we are. And just to say that obviously I am back, but, you know, because obviously people might be like, well, she's gone again. Where's she gone now? What's happening? She's back and then she's left again. Sarah pushing me out of the podcast again.
No, you're back like a bad smell.
Yep, just hanging around, never leaving.
Yeah.
That's how I describe myself, you know.
Is that what you put in your bio?
Yeah. We've just been invited back to be filter judges for the British Podcast Awards, which we're both really, really, really proud that they've invited us to do that. But we had to put a bio, and that's what I put, Sarah. Hangs around like a bad smell. But anyway, no, so we are back, but obviously Sarah recorded with Ollie while I was still away, so just wanted to pop in and say what an amazing episode. Well done, Sarah. Amazing work, Ollie.
Well, amazing work, Ollie. So articulate. We can only dream of being that articulate.
I know, and it's been edited and it's still long, and he didn't need
a lot of editing for him. Me, every few seconds.
You always need a lot of editing, as do I, Sarah, as do I.
Thanks for listening to the HIV podcast. If you enjoyed our podcast, please like, rate and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
You can now also follow us on Instagram and TikTok at the HIV podcast for behind the scenes insights and video.
The HIV podcast is produced by Thames Valley Positive Support. Step onto the legendary clay courts of Roland Garros, where the world's best players battle it out at the French Open for a chance to win a Grand Slam title. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. See the action unfold as legends fight for glory and new rivalries emerge. Daily live coverage begins Monday, May 20th, with match replays on demand so you never miss a moment. From the first serve to the final point, Roland Garros promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history. Stream now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.